have a second.
Supervisor Flanders?
May I please report? I'm Joe Longley here on behalf of Mr. Nick Trail, the petition is called. Mr. Sanders is co-counsel in this case, and Mr. Sanders is attorney of Texas, who is the lawyer to try the case. And happy to be in the third portion, the third case in order this morning. We have taken the suggestion by Justice Ray and have provided the court with copies of the exhibits that we need to be referring to.
Good, we appreciate that.
And I hope that will help make it a little fast as well. This case, to give you a little bit of background, is a value fire cost case. It's a failure to pay case, one which involved extra contractual damages, travel damages under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and 2021 Insurance Code, as well as findings on the deed of good faith and fair dealing. This was, these findings were made back in the days before the cases that this court has ruled upon in Mayo, Marshall, Chitsey, and Arnold, and as well now on Melody Homes. This application was filed before the court in September of 85, and since that time, since the writ has been pending before this court, all of these other cases that I just mentioned came to pass. So, although you've got enough brief probably in the file to hire a great time to jump over them, I think that the case boils down to a letter brief that was filed by the respondent, Texas Farm Bureau Insurance Company, on November 12th, and a brief that we filed in response to it yesterday. And that's basically what I think the positions of the parties are with regard to whether or not there exists now a cause of action under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and or Article 2121 of the Insurance Code.
Is that their letter of brief of November 10th?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And we filed a response to that yesterday, a 9-page brief in response. We would maintain that the statutes themselves clearly show that there is a cause of action for claims handling. Obviously, this court is well aware, and the members of this court are well aware, of the legislative history of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and Article 2121 of the Insurance Code. They were both passed in the same bill, House Bill 417, effective May 21, 1973. Concurrent with that, this court knows there were two separate causes of action that were found in those bills, because one part of the bill, what we call the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, co-authored by Justice Wallace and Justice Mulvey, changed the Business and Commerce Code and created a separate cause of action under Section 17.5 of the Business and Commerce Code for a claim for any kind of insurance practice that was in violation of 2121. Likewise, House Bill 417, that's ultimately passed, it was originally introduced to Senate Bill 75, provided for a separate cause of action under Section 16 of Article 2121. Texas Farm Bureau Insurance Company confuses these two causes of action. In their letter brief, if the court had read it, they would have this court believe that the two causes of action are one and the same. And of course, just a cursory reading of the two causes of action shows they're quite different. And there was a reason for why they were quite different. As this court may recall, there was some political horse trading that went on with regard to whether or not the Attorney General's office would have the ability to directly file suit against insurance companies. And in the process of the legislative wrangling that went on, the Attorney General's office bowed out of having direct action against insurance companies in favor of giving two private causes of action found in these statutes to people who might be harmed. Under Section 16 of Article 2121, which you find to my left and in your exhibits, you find that any person who was harmed had a cause of action. A person who was injured by another engaging in the practice declared in Section 4 of this article. So the first cause of action was limited to Section 4 of Article 2121. Or in rules or regulations lawfully adopted under this article, or in any practice defined in Section 17.46 of the DPPA. Now, this is a more limited cause of action than you find for consumers over in Section 17.50, because the legislature there specifically limited the causes of action to particular sections of laws. Section 4 of Article 2121 and Section 17.46 of the DPPA. And this court most recently in Epic County versus Marshall noted that difference, noted that Section 16 of Article 2121 did not incorporate all of the DPPA. Otherwise, someone would have to be a consumer to sue under Section 16, and that clearly is not the standing requirement of any person who has been injured by it. And this court made very clear the difference in standing in the Edmund versus Marshall case. Conversely, under Section 17.50, a consumer, and you'll note that the heading of the statute says relief for consumers. You have to be a consumer in order to have standing to sue. You have to be an individual, partnership, or corporation whose sought or acquired by purchase or lease any goods or services, so the legislature did. And the legislature also put an exemption section in Section 17.49, and you will note in both of these statutes there is no exemption. There is no language that says for violation of Article 2121, comma, except for claims handling conduct. You don't find an exemption there. You don't find it in the exemption section. And as a matter of fact, the exemption that was in the old Deceptive Trade Practices Act was repealed by House Bill 417 that related to insurance. And I make reference to that. In fact, that was some of the testimony between Representative Heatley and then Attorney General Hill that took place in the hearings on House Bill 417 before the House Committee on Business and Industry. Representative Heatley specifically asked about the insurance industry at that point. And then General Hill stated, it deals with any firm or individual who is engaged in a deceptive trade practice as defined by the bill, so the answer to the question would be yes at any level or from any source. Clearly, there is no exemption in either statute. And the old exemption was repealed, so you would think, and there's a liberal construction in both statutes to protect consumers or to protect people against unfair practices. So the logical conclusion that one must draw from the legislative history, at least, is that claims handling in insurance claims was to be covered. It was not to be excluded, it was to be included. Because the legislature has proven in these statutes that they know how to exclude something when they want to. They simply put a provided however semicolon and start excluding it. And you don't find that in either of these statutes. So I think we start from the premise in this case that claims handling is covered. Now why did the Dallas Court of Appeals say that then that Mr. and Mrs. Bale could not recover trouble damages? They made an error. That's what happened. They made an error, just as they held that there was no cause of action for the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. This was before Arnold, although it was not before the Court of Appeals' decision in Marshall. Marshall held there was such a duty, failed. The Dallas Court held there was not. Now, this court in Arnold versus National County Court has held that there is such a duty, and of course, the Dallas Court of Appeals was in error on that holding as well. We finally concede that, that obviously points that are putting forward have to be sustained in this case because there is a cause of action that has been recognized in Arnold for the duty of good faith and fair dealing. The question that boils down to in this case is, why did the Dallas court not sustain the treble damages awarded by the trial judge? That's the focus of this whole appeal that I can see. And the Court of Appeals held that there was no cause of action under Article 2121 or Section 17.50 of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act because, citing a student note in the Baylor Law Review, a fine publication, but citing a student note with no further authority, because they said that the legislature intended to seal off claims handling practices from these other statutes by the passage of Article 2121-2, the so-called Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act, citing no other authority than that student note. And of course, there's been no case that's actually held that, and of course, the legislature has not done that. And since that time, as this court well knows, the legislature has reenacted Section 17.50 without any changes and without any exemptions of claims handling conduct. So the only explanation I can give you is that the Dallas Court of Appeals was in error on its holding with regard to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and Article 2121, just as it was on its holding that there was no duty of good faith and fair dealing that this court is now looking at. That really brings us down to the question of, well then, what are the elements of these calls of action. And of course, only this morning, the court has overruled the motions for rehearing in Chitsey. So we know what the elements are under Section 16 of Article 2121, where you're incorporating the rules and regulations. They are that the conduct took place and that there was acts that occurred with such frequency as special results in this important with such frequency as to make it rise to a general business practice. And the court held there, although in Chitsey they held that there was a cause, this court held there was a cause of action, they held that Mr. Chitsey had not proven all of the elements because he had not proven that frequency requirement. That's not the case here, and Mr. Sanders will address the record references as to the frequency that are found in the record here. I'll leave that to him to tell in my argument with the court commission. But we do have, as far as the Trade Practices Act is concerned, let me make the point, if I make none other today, that the cause of action under the DTPA is broader than the cause of action that has been recognized in Chitsey. And one need only look to Justice Polk's fine opinion in Spradlin v. Williams as to how you determine an unlisted deceptive trade practice to find out how you determine by law that something is an unlisted trade or deceptive trade practice. And if you'll recall that case with me for a moment, in Spradlin against Williams, the plaintiff there was suing for a situation that was not listed under the so-called laundry list. And there, Justice Polk says, where you do not have a listed trade practice, that you can sue and get a finding that something is deceptive, just like you can sue and get a finding that something is negligent, or just like you can sue and get a finding that some conduct constitutes estoppel or proximate cause. And what you have to do is submit to the jury the facts and get a finding that something is a deceptive trade practice. That is the very situation that we claim has occurred here. Now, you have a copy before you of the jury, the relevant jury charge, and not the jury found. We contend that the findings of the conduct, of course the jury was not asked if the work in Chitsey, does the handling of the claim constitute an unfair practice in the business of insurance? What the jury was asked here, actually, there were three particular questions, and any one of the three we feel would sustain the trial court's award of covered damages. Issue number four, do you find from a preponderance of the evidence that defendants intentionally failed to exercise good faith in the investigation, processing, and denial of the claim as the basis of this lawsuit? Answer, we do. Intentionally failed to exercise good faith. On that finding alone, we feel that the requirements of Spradlin against Williams have been met, that there has been an unlisted, unfair practice or deceptive practice in the business of insurance that has been found by the jury. Moreover, we feel that this court's opinion in Arnold constitutes a per se unfair or deceptive act or practice in the business of insurance, if you meet the requirements of Arnold. That is something that has been found pursuant by law. Let me dwell a moment about the difference between the causes of action under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act of 2121. You'll note that 2121 is very specific about the kind of conduct that it incorporates for a cause of action. Whereas under Section 17.50 of the DTPA, it says a consumer may maintain an action if he has been adversely affected. By the way, this is an old act case, so it uses the term adversely affected rather than producing cause. If he has been adversely affected by the use or employment by any person of an act or practice in violation of Article 2121. Notice it doesn't say Section 4 of Article 2121 like you find over in Section 16. If you're a consumer and if you're a mom and pop who has come out of your hip pocket with hard-earned premium dollars, the legislature gave you a leg up. They gave you a break. They said, we incorporate all of Article 2121, not just Section 4. Now certainly, a person can be injured, it can be an agent, it can be another insurance company. The standing requirement is much broader under Section 16, but there's less that you can sue for. And conversely, under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, consumers, you have a smaller standing requirement, but if you are a consumer, as the bailiff were here, then you have a much broader cause of action. It incorporates all of Article 2121. Not just Section 4, and not just Section 17.46 of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Incorporate all. So, applying that to the facts that we have here. Here, Mr. and Mrs. Vale have gotten findings. Not only, as I just read to you, that there was intentional failure to exercise good faith, but they got a finding that the defendant, after it became reasonably clear that he was liable under the policy, did not attempt in good faith to effectuate a prompt, fair, and equitable settlement of the claims submitted by the plaintiffs. Yet another defined deceptive act or practice that you find in 2121-2. Now, we would respectfully submit to the court that you have two avenues to go if you get to the same location. Number one, Arnold versus National County Mutual has determined, pursuant by law, as Section 3 requires of Article 2121, that the determination has been made that if you delay or deny a claim without justification, that has now been pursuant by law to be found to be a breach of the duty that is an unfair practice in the business of insurance. We submit. If you don't like that argument, there is the backup argument that there has been a finding by the jury in this case, at least two findings, of an unfair practice in the business of insurance, and it has been pursuant by law, as this court laid out in Spradley against Williams, a unanimous opinion written by Justice Pope. An unlisted practice has been found by the jury that was pled and proven by the plaintiffs. If you don't like that argument, there is, of course, the Chitsey argument. The Chitsey argument is, of course, that there is a cause of action under 2121-2, and those are rules and regs that are incorporated under 2121, but you have to show frequency. You have to show frequency of the acts. And
well, I don't know if you've read the amended opinion on motion to rehear it. It drops out the language about private cause of action.
So under 2121-2, you know, there was one sentence.
Yes, sir, and I have that
opinion. I want you to tell us where you stand if that sentence is now deleted from
the... If it says, and I'm looking here, it says, while the latter order also allows a private cause of action, it requires proof of more than a single act.
Yeah, that sentence, say that's gone out of it.
I think that doesn't change our position at all. We still say there's a cause of action for conduct and claims handling, and if the rest of the opinion stood, it just merely said Mr. Chitsey didn't meet the elements that you would have to show, which would be frequency.
Well, then argue to us if that is correct, and that's where the court now stands. We've been hit with a lot of contention here that 2121-2, as distinguished from 2121, simply did not create a private cause of action.
We can see that.
Well, then let's go forward then and tell us where you want this case decided.
We want this case decided that 21, it hasn't been pled that there is a cause of action in 2121-2, just like it wasn't pled under Marshall, just like it wasn't pled under Chitsey, that the cause of action is under 21.21. And that cause of action would incorporate anything that the human mind could plead. Let's just say that there wasn't a 2121-2, and let's say that Mr. Vale pled that they failed to effectuate a prompt, fair, and equitable settlement. Period. And that there wasn't a 2121-2. Why is that not covered? You don't find an exemption in either statute.
Well, I can't remember the board number order in Chitsey.
41454.
But that clearly says it was promulgated pursuant to 2121-2.
No question about that.
Okay.
And 2121, the board order promulgated pursuant to it, which was 41040, or its predecessor, which was 18663, that you have in this case, it incorporated all of those board orders that were promulgated under 2121-2. So, and of course, you see the cause of action in 2121. It says any rule or regulation promulgated under this article, 41060 was promulgated under that article, and it incorporated all the others, and any other law, including Section 3. Section 3 of Article 2121. You don't have to get into these board orders to hold either for Chitsey or for the Vales, is my point.
It was just a question of the academics of it. That is, the 2121 we're all familiar with how broad it is and what all it covers, and if you get orders under it, make any difference. And we all, I think, understand that. We just want you to be sure that you're not basing some part of your argument on something that was deleted from the chit.
That's fine, Your Honor, and if it helped this argument go any faster, we would concede that 2121-2 does not create a private cause of action for individuals. That if we have a cause of action, it's under 2121, as it either incorporates the rules and regulations or unlisted conduct, as was done in Spratton against Williams.
Hey, Captain, take no offense at my leaving. I won't be gone very long.
Or under Arnold versus National County Mutual, but now it has been found pursuant by law. And if I might get some help from Mr. Kincaid, the board order provides that you may find something pursuant by law. And I know in the Chitz's opinion there was some language about that the jury was asked to find a question of law. Let me respectfully submit to you that juries find questions of law every day in this state. Proximate cause is a question of law. Negligence is a question of law, or at least they are mixed questions. Estoppel, waiver, all of those things constitute questions of law, just as deceptive trade practice would so constitute. But this court, in Spratton against Williams, said that you may submit that to the jury with proper instruction and get a finding. And that is pursuant by law, with all due respect.
I've made that argument before, and I can't remember if it was in Marshall or in which case.
Probably Chitsey.
It was an argument in Chitsey. All you had to do was have a jury finding, and then that amounted to a finding of law.
That's correct, and that's exactly the holding of Spratton against Williams. You had a finding there of deceptive trade practice that was not listed in Section 17.46. Judge Pope said there that the way you submit that case is, A, did the defendant commit the conduct? Here it would be, did they fail to effectuate prompt, fair, and equitable settlement once liability become clear? And the jury found that issue too.
I don't recall your citing an opinion by Judge Pope previously.
Yes, sir. And we would rely heavily upon that authority that, pursuant by law, that at least this court has equal dignity with a bureaucrat at the State Board of Insurance. Surely it has that equals aid. And if a bureaucrat at the State Board of Insurance can find something pursuant by law, why cannot this court do the same? Why does not its opinions as to the law rise to the same dignity? I would submit respectfully that they do, and this court has so found in Arnold versus National County Mutual, in Marshall against Aetna, in Tiffany versus National Lloyds, and the Mayo versus John Hancock Insurance. These cases all stand for proposition that claims handling is covered under these statutes. They are not excluded. Claims handling is not excluded. And just because certain identified conduct appears in a statute that does not create a private cause of action, it comes under the so what doctrine. There are many, many items, such as running a stop sign, using excessive speed that appear in the highway code, but that doesn't create a private cause of action. The highway code does not create a private cause of action to individuals who are injured by someone exceeding speed limits or running a stop sign. But the common law allows you to plead. If you run a stop sign, you don't have to submit whether or not that was negligence, because it's defined as negligence by the law. The law does that. It's negligence per se. Why doesn't the same thing apply when the legislature passes a statute and does not exempt out this kind of conduct? Why can't a person injured in the business of insurance simply say, they didn't handle my claim properly? They denied it without justification. They falsified fire reports. They ignored their own report that said there was no arson. They went out and found another man that they finally got to say that maybe there was arson, and they had no evidence that the arson was committed by the insurers, but they still continue to deny the claim. Why can't you plead those kind of facts just like you would running a stop sign? Because they appear in 2121-2. If they did not appear there, why couldn't you just plead them as a matter of course? This court in Spratton said that unlisted practices are necessary to the proper administration of these acts, because both acts are to be liberally construed to protect the people who are injured, because the human mind has infinity as to its inventiveness to have new deceptive trade practices and new unfair practices. You've got to have some type of to find that conduct is unfair or deceptive, even if it's not listed in some statute someplace. My time is up as far as, yes, sir.
I'm on one answer. Go to page 6 of the slip opinion of CA. The duties and responsibilities of a liability carrier are not the same as those of a property insurer. It's an effort to distinguish good faith and fair dealing. In this case, in the Stowers case, and I assume now in the Arnold. Do you have any comment to make on that particular
case? Yes, Your Honor. I would simply say, and this is the same argument that I have used in these cases before, the duty is greater where you are dealing with the person who has put their trust and their money with your insurance company for their claims, because the legislature has created these duties for consumers and persons injured. And bear in mind that even in Stowers, that was a first-party case. The person that had purchased the liability policy did not get the insurance services that they had paid for because the insurance company negligently handled the claim, and it was that negligence to the insurer, the guy who paid the money, that created the cause of action, just as it is here. That's my answer to that question. I think the court heard my speech on that before. I would like to spend what time remains to have Mr. Sanders give you the record references as to the frequency with regard to the Chitsey matter.
Are they set out in his brief?
They are set out in the application for writ of error, but I think that since Chitsey has come down, the original writ was not filed with the frequency issue in mind. I think it might be well to give you the record references just so they'll be convenient for the court if you wish to see if there's any evidence of the frequency of the claim.
Yeah, please, the court. I'd like to address this very briefly, why I think if you get to the kind of sentence that Justice Hill was talking about, why that might be important for you to know at least another perspective that's not completely reflected in our brief. First of all, in this case, there are two claims. One was for the property itself and one for the contents. That is a distinction between Chitsey and here. And while that may be a tenuous distinction in perspective that there's only one additional claim, the fact is that what the insurance company did was bargain off a given liability, namely the $25,000 they knew they had to pay, against a questionable liability, that is the amount of contents. And that in itself reflects that there was some perspective or dealing with more than one claim. They knew it at the time they dealt with it. The second point is the frequency of the events with which, or the acts with which they raised and how they dealt with the claims is fairly important. It reflects absolutely their business practice. In Chitsey, you had a couple of piddling adjusters who piddled while the house and the house fire claim burned. But in this case, we had that up to the end of July of 1979. That happened. They made the decision not to pay willingly, and the fact is that there was no indication that they were seriously looking at investigating the claim. That those are passive portions of the claim and not passive bad faith. But beyond that, as reflected on pages 9 through about 14 of our brief, we show that there are a whole series of things that they did which amounted to active cover-up, deception, I would say obstruction of justice, because they falsified records that they produced in the Grayson County Courthouse. They lied and did about all that you can do to screw up a claim and try to persuade a jury and a court that they were acting in good faith. I won't go into particulars, but you have everything from the denial of the claim on the basis of not turning in a contents list when there is a structure issue there, or a structure claim. You have that and the changing of the basis for claim denial. You have...
Are you admitting your clients did all that?
That my clients did what?
Not his.
I'm not sure I'm following your argument.
My argument is that the insurance company did all of this in the investigation.
His client did all of this.
That's correct. But let me say that it's rather interesting that the jury was asked, did they screw up or have bad faith in the investigation, processing, and denial? Three separate phases, and there was no objection to that issue. So that frequency, to the extent that you may be looking at frequency of acts, is reflected in the jury finding. Yes, they had bad faith in the investigation, had bad faith in the processing, and bad faith in denial. And if you follow what the insurance company did, I would challenge your mental processes here to see if you ever had a case like this, to look at all of the things that they did from A to Z and see if you can find a case where they actually walk into the courthouse with bogus, falsified arson records. My time is up. I regret not to be able to respond first.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Jimmy Davis will present arguments for these charges.
You're the one I ought to ask if you've met your clients at all.
May it please the court, my name is Sid Davis, firm of Texas Renee Johnson, Bell and Smith. I'm here for respondent Texas Farm Bureau Mutual Insurance Company. One brief general comment as to Mr. Longley's argument, and that is he's made some interesting arguments about the DDPA and the insurance code, but they bear very little relationship to the pleadings in this case. And that's what I intend to focus upon in my argument. I have to admit I was a little bit puzzled when the court granted the writ in this case only a week after it handed down its initial decision in Chitsey, because Chitsey seemed to me then, and it seems to me now, to be dispositive of the issues we have in this case. The only thing after studying it for a number of weeks that I can see that's different between Chitsey and this case is that Chitsey was a 2121 Section 16 case under the insurance code, and this is a DTPA case. It makes a difference as to later on some troubling and damages argument for whether the old act and the new act. But other than that, I don't think that makes very much difference. In addition, the pleadings in Chitsey were apparently broader than the pleadings in this case. And that may well make some difference. In fact, it would make this case a much stronger case for the defendant than was Chitsey. I have passed out also before a single sheet which has the statutory pleading in this case. It was made by them. It's not attached. That's it. Copper has Roman numeral 9 in the alternative. That is the sole pleading of any violation of any statute that is in this case. And as the court can see, the underlining there is mine. It's not in the original. It says in the alternative, defendant violated the Texas Business and Commerce Code section 17.50A4 by, and I stress the word by, employing or using acts which violate Article 2121 or rules and regulations issued pursuant to Article 21, and then it's further limited as follows: by engaging in practices contrary to Section 4A of Insurance Court Order 18663, which acts are declared to be unfair or deceptive as defined by 2121-2, Section 2D. It's a very limited pleading. Leaves only one cause of action in the statute, that is a violation of the DTPA, as it incorporates Court Order 18663, as that allegedly incorporates the definitions under Article 2121-2. And it is on that limited pleading, I believe that the Court of Appeals affirmed, reversed the trial court's judgment, and upon which this court could affirm the Court of Appeals. There's no pleading in this case of Section 16 under Article 2121. There is absolutely no pleading of a violation of the remedy section of Article 2121. What you have before you is the sole statutory pleading, and petitioners have claimed that the reference to Article 2121 there is a general reference. I think you can see by looking at it that it's not. It's simply a delineation of the types of acts under the DTPA that they were complaining of. It says it's by violating 2121 or the border. There's no pleading in addition, and this is an important point which distinguishes this case perhaps from Chitsey on the pleading. There's no pleading in this case of Section 4B of Board Order 18663. Section 4B is the section which says any violation of an unfair act is determined pursuant by law. That's not in this case. And we can argue about that all day, but it's not pled in the case. All that's pled is what you have before you. There's also no pleading of any violation of any board order under Article 2121-2. Chitsey involved Board Order 41454. That's not in the pleadings of this case. In addition to the sheet you have before you, there was one pleading of a common law cause of action, the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing. I'd like to discuss that one first because I think we can handle it fairly quickly. If Arnold applies to this case, and again, as Mr. Longley pointed out, this case predates Arnold, But if Arnold does apply to this case, and the findings of the jury establish the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing, it's immaterial to the resolution of this case. Plaintiffs, the petitioners, have already been awarded their actual damages from the fire loss and prejudgment interest along with it, and attorney's fees. Respondents have never contended since the time of the trial that they shouldn't be awarded that money. We have appealed solely on the treble damages aspect of this case.
Was there any finding of punitive damages?
No, Your Honor, there was not. There was no request for an issue on punitive damages. There was no issue on punitive damages. At the time the case went to trial, there was no pleading of punitive damages. So just like in Chitsey, as this court held in Chitsey, the finding of a breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing, if it exists, is immaterial, because they've already gotten all the relief they'd be entitled to for a violation of that common law standard. The violation of the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing, if it exists, was not pled independently as a violation of Article 2121 of the Insurance Code or Article 17.50 of the DTPA. So any argument that somehow you can incorporate the Arnold standard or the Stouwer standard into the DTPA, while interesting academically, is not relevant to this case. Therefore, there's no way this court, I don't believe, can support a treble damages award under a breach of duty and good faith and fair dealing. The trial court simply can't treble the amount of the fire loss and say, here's your punishment for a breach of duty and good faith and fair dealing. Turning then back to the statutory cause of action. The Bales argument, again, I don't want to bore the court by being repetitive, but their argument is that although the DTPA doesn't expressly prohibit unfair claim settlement practices, there's no dispute about that. It's not listed anywhere in the DTPA. And although Board Order 18663 doesn't say a word about unfair claim settlement practices, and although Article 2121-2 does not create a private cause of action, which they concede, that if you put all three of them together in a pot, stir it up, you come up with a private cause of action for unfair claim settlement practices. We believe that's simply not the case. There are a number of cases which have rejected that rationale. I'd like to read very briefly from the opinion in a case which is not cited in the briefs, Lexington Insurance Company versus Bennett Evans Grain Company, which is an opinion by Hugh Gibson from the Southern District of Texas, 642. Fed Sup 86 opinion, which addresses this very point. After noting that Article 2121-2 does not create a private cause of action, the court stated, beyond the simple lack of language creating a private cause of action, this conclusion makes sense. Article 21.21-2 prohibits unfair claim settlement practices. Section 2 of 2121-2 explicitly states that the Unfair Claim Settlement Acts must be committed with sufficient frequency to actually be a practice. Thus, a private cause of action for one unfair claim settlement would be inconsistent with Section 2. The court goes on, after citing the lower court opinion in this case, Bale, says that by enacting 2121-2, the 63rd legislature showed that it clearly understood the nature of an unfair claim settlement. The 63rd Texas Legislature also clearly understood how to grant a private cause of action. It did so in Section 16 of the Article 2121 and Section 17.50 of the DTPA. By cross-referencing the DTPA and Section 16 of the Insurance Code, the 63rd Texas Legislature showed that it knew how to expressly import a private cause of action into one statute from another. Yet the legislature did not create a private cause of action for unfair claim settlements in 2121-2, nor did the 63rd Texas Legislature explicitly enforce 2121-2 into either the DTPA or Article 2121. The court finally notes, and I'm still quoting, that if the DTPA or Article 2121 by their own terms prohibit unfair claim settlements, Article 21.21-2 is superfluous. The DTPA and Article 21.21 authorize state agency action. If they prohibit unfair claim settlements, 2121-2 authorizes nothing new. And commenting specifically about the argument made by petitioners in this case that you can incorporate one board order under 2121, and then that supposedly incorporates either another board order or 2121-2, the court said, that the court disagrees with this tortuous logic. In addition to the Lexington opinion, in addition to the Gypsy opinion, there have been a number of other cases recently. Again, these are more recent than our major briefing in this case because the case has been up here so long, and I apologize to the court for not having printed these out for you. But the case of Cantu, which this court NRE, Cantu versus Western Fire, 716, Southwest 2nd, 737, states that there's no cause of action under 2121-2 of the insurance code, no private cause of action under pleadings, exactly like the pleadings in this cause. The court today in its orders read that a writ was dismissed in the case of Lee versus SafeMate Life Insurance Company, 737 Southwest 2nd, 84. The Lee case is directly on point. It says that Article 21.21 doesn't reach unfair claim settlements, that the board orders are not actionable under 2121, and that 2121-2 is not privately actionable. In the briefs, when we briefed this case, both in the Court of Appeal and when the application for the error was filed, Vail relied heavily upon one federal court decision in Austin versus Servat, the decision of Judge Fisher. That decision has now been reversed by the Fifth Circuit, Austin versus Servac, 794, Fed Second 941, in which case the Fifth Circuit held that there is no cause of action under Article 2121 of the DPA. Excuse me, it's just under Article 2121, but there is no cause of action under 2121 as it incorporates any sort of board order or unfair claim settlement practice. I've already discussed the Lexington opinion. There's one other opinion from the Southern District of Texas as well, 640 Southwest 2nd, 278, the case of South Texas National Bank of Laredo. Summarizing then all these cases and the arguments that we're making in this court, frequency is a requirement under 2121-2. Even if there was some argument that could be made that 2121-2's definition somehow imported or incorporated into these board orders, the definitions require that the acts be committed with such frequency as to indicate a general business practice. And the court made reference to that in the Chitsey opinion. I think this is very significant in this case because one act does not an unfair claim settlement practice make. I would point out to the court under Article 2121-2, in addition to the language that something must be committed without cause and performed with such frequency, it says, as determined by the State Board of Insurance as provided for in this Act. It's not an unfair claim settlement practice as defined by 2121-2 unless the State Board of Insurance says it is. And there are specific administrative procedures set out in 2121-2 for determining what is an unfair claim settlement practice. You have to have reports, complaints, you have a public hearing. All those things are required before something becomes an unfair claim settlement practice. You can't incorporate it into 2121 and create a private cause of action for an individual act. As to Mr. Sanders' argument that there's evidence of frequency in this case, I strongly disagree. The frequency he's talking about is not the frequency the Act talks about to begin with. The Act is talking about frequency of denying claims as to indicate a general business practice, not a frequency of events in one case which resulted in the denial of a claim. I would point out that the language of Article 2121-2 prohibits unfair, the actual language cited in the pleading in this case prohibits not attempting in good faith to effectuate prompt, fair, and equitable settlements of claims, plural. And that, again, has to be done with such frequency as to indicate a general business practice. The issues in this case, the charge in this case, inquired of the jury whether or not the defendant failed to exercise good faith in denying the claim. Quoting from Special Issue Number 3, did it not attempt in good faith to effectuate prompt, fair, and equitable settlement of the claim submitted by the plaintiffs? That's a singular as opposed to a plural. And again, as the court pointed out in Lexington, Article 2121-2 will become completely superfluous if its provisions are somehow incorporated into Article 2121 in the DPPA. We cited in our brief some older cases, the McKnight case, the Lone Star versus Griffin case. The court's aware of those. We believe Chitsey case is dispositive of the incident case. The findings in Chitsey were similar. In fact, findings in Chitsey indicate more than one act, just like under Mr. Sanders' arguments in this case. Quoting from the opinion in Chitsey, plaintiff specifically alleged that they failed to properly evaluate and investigate the claim. So there was, if you want to use a pleading to say that he failed to investigate, evaluate, and pay, that's not multiple claims, just like it's not in Chitsey. With respect to the Supreme Court opinions in the last couple of years, I'd like to discuss those briefly. I've addressed them in my letter brief that was filed last week.
The Arnold case, we believe, is not material to the resolution of this case that we've already discussed, because the breach of duty in good faith and fair dealing is not going to give bail any more relief than he's already got. The Marshall case is not really relevant either. It's a pre-loss misrepresentation case. Under Marshall, there was a specific pleading of section 17.46B5 misrepresented goods or services and misrepresented what was going to come under the agreement. It's not an unfair claim settlement practice case as pled. The Mayo case is not on point for two reasons. First of all, the court specifically stated in Mayo that the question of what the pleading said and whether or not the pleading was sufficient was not before the court. What was before the court was a summary judgment improvidently granted based upon the fact that the petitioners had already recovered under section 3.62 of the insurance code a penalty. Whether or not that precluded any recovery under the insurance code or the DTPA. And this court held, no, it doesn't preclude any cause of action under the DTPA. The court did, there was one sentence in the opinion that said we didn't know that the pleading stated cause of action. I don't think that's the holding of the court, but even if it is, the Mayo pleadings
stated we would take the position it was stated because it was a cause of action stated for pre-loss misrepresentation. It's not, again, solely a claim handling case. Very briefly, in a few more minutes that I have left, Bales also argued in this court that section 1.14 of the insurance code defines the term insurance business and somehow should be incorporated into Article 21.21. I will point out to the court that this argument, number one, is irrelevant because, again, 21.21 is not part of this case. It wasn't pled. But in addition, there's no indication that the definition insurance business under the unauthorized insurer statute has anything to do with unfair claim practices or any other part of the insurance code. In addition, the very definition that they relies upon doesn't really say anything about claim handling. It says that you're in the insurance business if you act as an agent in handling claims. It doesn't say anything about committing unfair claims from the practices. And finally, it doesn't overcome their pleadings in this case. We would ask this court to conclude that there is no cause of action for unfair claim settlement practice stated under the pleadings in this case, and therefore the judgment of the court of appeals must be affirmed. The court granted the writ of error in this case on the first four points raised by Bale, which had to do with is there a cause of action for these things. I would point out to the court that there were a number of other points before the court below dealing with whether or not there was any evidence of damage which could be credible. I'll be happy to address those if the court is interested in them. I intend not to do that since the court didn't grant the writ on those points. But I would ask the court to examine the brief if there's any question in the court's mind about finding a cause of action in this case, which after Chitsey, I don't believe it could be. To examine the brief in this case, you will see that there was no issue submitted to the jury on actual damages resulting from any unfair claim settlement practice, and that therefore there's nothing for the court to credit. We would ask the court, therefore, if there are no questions, to confirm the judgment of the court of appeals.
Thank you, counsel.
Damages in this case. suffice it to say, the court will look at pages 64 and 73 of the transcript and page 3 of the appellant's brief in the Court of Appeals, you will find where Mr. Davis is firm and interest having stipulated that the actual damages, in fact, or what they underline was actual damages were $35,000. Those amounts are $25,000 under a value policy for the building itself which burned, plus the $10,000 which was found by the jury. I don't think it requires too much argument or analysis to see that in a case where the insurer is found guilty of not paying the claim, not acting in good faith to effectuate a prompt, fair, and equitable settlement after liability becomes reasonably clear, as a matter of law, the damages are the amount that should be paid under the policy. That's one of the lessons I think of Mayo, that the policy benefits are an element of damages in this type of case. There may be other elements of damages like mental anguish, but I just don't think it would stand reasoning to say these aren't their damages subject to traveling if they fail to pay. Also, we cite Edna versus Marshall, call that to the court's attention. One of the elements of damages in that case, in addition to the mental anguish, was the $355 that had not been paid under the policy. So when they stipulated three times that policy benefits and actual damages of $35,000, to say there are no actual damages subject to traveling in this case, we submit this wrong.
I thought I'm studying to say there's no actual damages subject to traveling under the good faith break.
Your Honor, I think you made that argument as well, that even if we have actual damages, they're not subject to traveling for various reasons which he gave you. But I believe his last argument, which they've made in the brief, is that there aren't any actual damages at all, even if you find there's a cause of action that was traveling. And that was the point I wanted to clear up. Also, on the pleadings court.
Counsel, before you move on,
yes,
I think his argument was no damages submitted on unfair settlement practice, which is the basis of the lawsuit. Would you respond to that, besides the good faith argument that just
Yes, sir, Your Honor. I think in this type of case, there's no requirement that you say what damages were caused by the unfair settlement practice, because as a matter of law, if you find out what the policy benefits were, in this case, it's no longer disputed what the benefits were. $25,000 value policy for the building. The jury did find the value of the content, which was $10,000. Once you find those benefits, as a matter of law, if those benefits haven't been paid, those are the damages, some of the damages they sustained as a result of an unfair settlement practice. It makes no sense and adds nothing to then ask the jury in magic words what damages are caused by the unfair practice. If you ask the jury what amount should have been paid under the policy, or as in this case, what were the benefits, what was the value, the content, that's defining the damages. Those are the damages. It's simply adding needless words to say damages resulting from the unfair practice, and it gives you one issue which provides both your contract damages and your statutory damages. Now, of course, if they're going to submit mental anguish, then his argument, I think, would have some merit. You would need to say, what amount of mental anguish damages do you find result from the refusal to pay? But when we're talking about policy benefits, I think the finding we've got in the stipulation are sufficient for damages as a matter of law. That would be our position. Another point I'd like to address, and that is who Chizzy supports. I think Chizzy does control the disposition of this case, or can control it, because it does correctly recognize that conduct is defined in Board Order 41454, which is also conduct in 2121-2. It's absolutely correct. No private cause of action is provided by either that rule or that statute. But as the court in Chizzy recognized, and as the statute is very clear and the rules are very clear, a cause of action is granted by Section 16 of Article 2120. A cause of action is granted by DTPA Section 1750A4. That's where the cause of action is. You only reach out to this other board order, this other statute, which do not give a private cause of action, to define the conduct. Our argument is not that they create private cause of action. Our argument is they list conduct that we can sue for under these other statutes that do provide private cause of action. That's the mistake that was made in all the cases cited by Mr. Davis. They said 2121-2 provides no private cause of action. That's right. Their conclusion that therefore you have no private cause of action was absolutely wrong. You do have a private cause of action under 2121 section 16 and under DPA section 1758-4. If I may give the court an analogy, accepting the argument that because Board Order 41454 doesn't give a private cause of action, there isn't one, or because 2121-2 doesn't give a private cause of action, there isn't one, that would be like going to DPA section 1746, the laundry list, which defines prohibited conduct. You'll find no private cause of action in that statute, but it would be ridiculous to say, therefore, there is no private cause of action. That's because that's the place the legislature defined conduct. They went over to another section to give a private cause of action. It's nothing new or novel to argue that one statute lists conduct, one statute gives a private cause of action. That's why the cases cited by Mr. Davis cause no problem. They're right in their premise, they're wrong in their conclusion.
The court, let me ask you this. Yes. You're saying that irrespective of what statute under which the board order was promulgated, Section 16A of Article 2121 creates a private cause of action for a violation of that board order.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in this case, more specifically, because of the way it was pled, he chose to go through DPA Section 1758-4, which then incorporates all of Article 2121, which incorporates the board order. And in fact, the Chifty opinion, even as it's been changed, sets out the statutory path very clearly on the last page of the court's opinion. The court recognizes that Board Order 41060 incorporates Board Order 41454. Board Order 41060 was promulgated under Article 2121. It reaches out and incorporates these other board orders. Admittedly, Board Order 41454 wasn't promulgated under Article 2121. That's why you can't go directly to it. You go through Board Order 41060, as the Chitsey opinion recognizes, which then incorporates this other board order. The language is very clear in the exhibits we've given to the court. Board Order 18663, which was then later changed to 41060, and now is in the Texas Administrative Code, Volume 28, beginning Section 21.1 through 21.5. make it easier for the court to find. Anyway, that board order says that unfair practices are prohibited that are defined in Article 2121 or by other provisions of the insurance code and by the rules and regulations of the State Board of Insurance. So it opens it up to other board orders promulgated under other statutes. The language is very clear. The language in Chitsey showing how that incorporation works is very clear. So Chitsey can be deposited. This really, despite all the briefing, all the development of the law since this case was first filed in this court in 1985, it really becomes a very simple case, I believe, because the question is there a cause of action under a statute that prohibits unfair insurance practices? Is there a cause of action for an insurance company that intentionally refuses to act in good faith to settle a claim after liabilities become reasonably clear? The common sense answer would be yes, of course. If the DPCA and the insurance code are going to prohibit any kind of conduct or protect anyone from anything, it's got to be this kind of case where liability is clear to the insurance company, but they still intentionally refuse to try to settle.
Would you briefly address a frequency requirement?
Yes, sir.
And a lack of a jury finding of a frequency?
Yes, sir. As the court noted in Chitsey, once you get to Board Order 41454 and read the language, it says with such frequency as indicated general business practice. I think that can be shown two ways reasonably. One, if I've shown other claims they've denied for other people to show a general business practice. But perhaps the most relevant is to show other things they've done to this insurer that are most directly relevant. And this is a very good case of that type of evidence. There were two claims submitted by the bail. Their contents claim of $10,000 for the amount was disputed. Their building claim, which was a value policy, the insurance company acted the same way with respect to both claims. Other evidence of frequency is the different things they did. They initially denied the claim because they said, well, you haven't given us a sufficient proof of loss or listing of content, even though it wasn't required for the value policy claim. Then, after that argument went away, they said, well, Mr. Bell misrepresented things to us. As it's set out in our application for writ of error, they gave up that claim because there just was no support. Another act in denying these claims is then they hired someone who would falsify these fire reports, and there is further evidence in the record, and the record references volume 8, pages 122 and 123, where in response to questions by Mr. Sanders, the representatives of the insurance company indicated that not only would they do this in this case, they intended to continue in the future. That, Your Honor, I submit is evidence that this was more than just one instance. It was a general practice. As to whether or not a finding is required, I believe a finding would be required. In this case, there was no objection. The objections are part of the transcript, the defendant's objection. There was no objection that frequency was not an element of the issue. You can look at their objections.
Whose burden was it to have a jury finding?
That would be part of the plaintiff's cluster, and that's our argument. Simply put, they did not object to the omission of the frequency element. Therefore, under Rule 279 and all the cases under Rule 279,
deemed finding
based on the evidence in the records, which I just tried to outline for the court. If there's any evidence, then it's deemed found in support of the judgment.
At that point, would you address if it's a deemed finding, would you relate that back to the pleading of which it would be a part of a deemed finding of a cause of action?
The pleading, well, we've given you each copy, and I believe it's the same copy that Mr. Davis is relying on. The pleadings in this case are very specific. They allege that the defendant violated DPA Section 1750A4 by engaging in conduct that then violated Article 2121, and then it goes further and incorporates Order 18663, which then incorporates Article 2121-2, which also tracks Order 41454, by not attempting in good faith to effectuate a prompt and equitable settlement of claims submitted in which liability has become reasonably clear. That is the conduct. The word frequency is not pled in there, just as it is not submitted. But again, there was never an objection or any special exception to the plea not having that frequency element in there. The pleading clearly alleged the cause of action under the relevant board order. The only missing element when it came time to submit it was frequency, and because they were clearly put on notice what board order and what statute was being sued under, they knew from reading it, if they were going to object to frequency was not included, that they were on notice that they needed to. There's no question what statute the Bales were pleading under, no question what board order they were alleging. So we respectfully submit this is precisely the type of case where they were put on notice. And this frequency element, which is now required by CHITSE, was part of the cluster that was being submitted under this board order and under this statute. And by not specifically objecting, the defendant has waived any objection on that point. And that will conclude my report. The court has other questions.
Thank you very much. All counsel, good arguments.
We're going to adjourn the court now.